Well, I know, but the mics are.
Good morning. Can you hear in the back?
Gotta get quiet.
Can we hold on a moment for technical purposes?
Maybe slant it this way.
Let's separate this one over here. Turn it that way. Can everyone hear me now? Okay. Hold on. It's not the mic.
I'm going to open this meeting of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. We are here for a public hearing. We want to welcome you all here. We apologize for the quality of the sound system, and we apologize that actually that not all of you probably will get an opportunity to speak. We have had an incredible number of people sign up. The guidelines that I'm going to go through shortly are going to describe how testimony will be presented. And we're trying today to hear from as many of you as possible and to hear from as diverse a number of subjects as possible. Before I start, I'm going to have each member that's here on the committee, both members of the full and other visiting legislators, introduce themselves. Because our system is not working well, they are going to have to stand and shout. So, Senator Dimbro.
Hey, everyone, welcome to PCC.
This is a good time for me to remind people, please do not applause and clap because it's going to take away from the time we have to hear people. Senator Manning.
Thank you. My name is Senator James Manning. I represent 7th District 7, which comes from Eugene and Junction City. Nice to be here to listen.
I'm Senator Arnie Copeland from District 5, which is most of the coast and Sheridan and Falls City in the valley.
Hello there. I'm Lou Frederick.
District 22, that's north and northeast Portland.
I'm Senator Richard Devlin. I represent Lower Southwest Portland, Lake Oswego, Tualatin, West Lynn, two small communities of Durham and River Grove, and we will get started right now. First of all, I will be calling three people up at a time to the table here to testify. I will also be calling three people up to sit in the on-deck chairs. They will be the next people to testify. Also, when you come up to testify, please start immediately. Don't wait to confer amongst yourselves. Whoever sits down first, start. Additionally, there are some additional things to keep in mind. One, please stay at the table until all three people have testified. In terms of this timer that you see before you here, you'll have 2 minutes and 2 minutes only. And please understand that that's so we can hear from as many people as possible and as diverse testimony as possible. For 90 seconds, the light will be green. Then for 30 seconds, it will be yellow. And then when it turns red, I regret this, but I will be cutting you off and going to the next person to testify. When you signed up, you made note of which area you wanted to testify on: education, human services, public safety, judiciary, natural resources, and other areas. We will be going from sheet to sheet so we get as much diversity as possible. Please, again, no applause during testimony because it's just going to take up valuable time. The members here on the committee will not respond to your questions, nor will they ask you questions. This actually ensures that we can hear from as many people as possible. If you cannot testify here today and you came to testify, please know that you can submit written testimony here. Our primary staff member is here at the right, my right end of the table, your left. And if you want to send in testimony, they have handed out an email address to do that. I will mention it only once. It's Ways and Means Budget, that's Ways and Means period budget, at OregonLegislature.gov. But actually, if you ask anyone that's here from the staff, they can also give it to you too. Also, I would like to state that for those of you who do not have an opportunity here to testify, we are having other hearings from members around the region here. I do know of one that will be in East County March 4th. You should have had a little sheet going out identifying where that's going to be. Actually, there'll be one March 9th in Washington County also at the Beaverton High School. And the other one will be at IRCO, the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, from noon to 2 p.m. on March 4th. We will get started right now. We have a short introduction from the president of the PCC Sylvania campus and also from a member of the PCC board, Denise Frisbee. If they would please come forward. And if you would also limit yourself to no more than 2 minutes each. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Thank you for giving us a brief moment. My name is Lisa Avery. I'm the campus president here at PCC Sylvania, and thank you for being here to hear from the community. At PCC, community truly is our middle name, and you see we've had a great turnout today from all kinds of people in Southwest Portland and further out to show how important that they are focusing right now on politics. There are a lot of people paying very close attention to politics these days, and it's an engaged citizenry, and we think that that's a wonderful thing here as educators. Denise Frisbee is with me and has been an 11-year member of our board of directors at PCC, and though we don't have time to introduce and welcome all of the other elected officials, including board of directors from PCC and elsewhere throughout the state, I want to recognize that we have a significant crowd today, also including other elected officials, and we appreciate their participation as well. Director Frisbee?
Good morning and welcome. And in addition to serving on the PCC board, I will say I'm a vice president of the Oregon Community College Association. So that's where my energies go. We all want to thank you for taking this road trip to really see what it looks like as you develop budget policy, what the impacts will be out in your communities and in our communities. It's greatly appreciated. I'm going to just tell you a little bit about PCC within my 2 minutes. We're looking at, before we know what our budget is, a $12 million shortfall. So that means in the next couple of months, the board will have to look at the very difficult decisions, options such as layoffs, dismantling critical programs and critical parts of our institution, and or tuition increases, or some combination. There isn't a single palatable option among those choices. And that's what we're grappling with. So we want to say, as you're evaluating the impacts of your budget making, we hope you will continue the quest for new revenue sources because it is desperately needed. And we know want to support you as you deal with the cost drivers that are impacting all of our budgets. Continue. We want to appreciate your work on the PERS reforms and tell you to keep going because more needs to be done. So thank you so much for doing this. We're really grateful for the opportunity to have you here and applaud your willingness to listen.
Thank you both. I will now call up the first panel, Terry Marichuk, Allison Gross, and Ethan Moses. On deck will be Diane, Diane S., might be Solomon, Adrian Enghouse, and Terry Mills. Please begin.
I'm Allison Gross. I have the privilege of teaching students here at PCC Sylvania. I believe corporations are not people. Corporations do not arrive in my cubicle every term with tears in their eyes and explain to me why they're missing my classes. Corporations are not asked to decide who has it worse, the student whose parents are at risk of being deported or the student who is homeless with a 10-month-old baby. Corporations do not have to decide between buying a $20 book for a class or eating food that week. Corporations do not have to stress about how to balance state and federal mandates with what they know is best for their students' learning when resources are scarce. Corporations don't feel pain, they don't experience disappointment, they don't lose sleep at night, they don't get hungry, sad, or afraid. Last fall, I believe Oregon taxpayers voted against their own best interests when they failed to pass Measure 97, buying into the fallacious arguments marketed by corporate interests. I also believe it is not the voters' fault that they made this mistake. Too many Oregonians lack the education required to understand such complicated measures. I believe that if enough people had access to good education, they would have been able to see through the lies posted on yard signs all over the city. They voted no out of fear, or they didn't vote at all, which is also a problem that stems from a lack of education and resources. And who can blame them? I believe that Oregon legislators have an ethical and moral duty to their constituents, to the real flesh and blood human beings who are responsible for them being in their position. I believe Oregon legislators can and should fix this problem, which amounts to nothing less than a crime against some of our most vulnerable populations, by once and for all saying no to the privileging of corporate over individual interests, no to budget shortfalls, no to wage freezes, no to maintaining the status quo. It's time for you to address head-on the failures of our tax system. I'm tired of watching colleagues worry about diminishing financial resources. I'm tired of seeing kindergarten teachers have to scrape together money in $5 increments for school supplies and field trips. I'm tired of explaining to my daughter why there isn't more art and music available for her in school. I'm tired of seeing people who've worked hard their whole lives continue to work long hours, unable to retire because they can't afford to. I'm tired of unchecked capitalism that allows the rich to get richer at the expense of the rest of us. I'm tired of bargaining for things I shouldn't have to bargain for. And most of all, I'm tired of your excuses.
Can we go to the next party?
My name is Terry Marchok, and I'm an educator in East Multnomah County. I serve on the Multnomah County Advisory Board for Trauma-Informed Practices, and I'm here to tell you about the mental health needs of families and children in East Multnomah County. High levels of poverty and exposure to domestic violence have created toxic stress environments for many children in East Multnomah County. Ask any educator or administrator if they're seeing dramatic increases in children with behavioral and mental health crises, and they will agree. The stress involved in high poverty environments can disrupt children's neurodevelopment and cause them to form maladaptive coping skills. In the school environment, this often presents as physically aggressive behaviors. In one East Multnomah County district, staff report a trifold increase in the number of kindergarten students that require safety plans with restraints. The resources available in our public schools for addressing these children's needs are minimal at best. The ratio of counselors to students is generally 1 to 500. School psychologists are spread among 2, sometimes 3 buildings. Most schools do not have behavioral specialists. The high numbers of children with behavioral and mental health needs do not get their needs met in our public schools because we do not provide the resources or staffing to meet their needs. While some opportunities to partner with mental health agencies exist, those partnerships often enter into flux easily, and services to children and families are not always consistent. mental and behavioral health matters. Toxic stress and the adverse experiences associated with living in poverty directly impact brain development. A stressed brain simply cannot learn. I'm here to urge you to consider the long-term expense of ignoring our children's mental health needs. Cuts to the Oregon Health Agency will impact many children's ability to access mental health supports in our schools. Cuts to early learning will deny children the chance to start off on the right foot in their school experience. Cuts to schools will have devastating consequences, not only for our students with mental and behavioral health needs, but for our families and our teaching staff. You have the choice of allowing these cuts.
Thank you.
Don't do it.
Thank you.
Invest revenue now.
The next person.
Hi, my name is Ethan Moses. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm a teacher with a Head Start program. Head Start is a state-funded early childhood education program for families living in poverty. I want to thank you all and the state of Oregon for the movement towards increased quality in early childhood education. I think that's fantastic. According to a study by the RAND Corporation, every dollar invested in early childhood education can have a benefit of up to $17 from government spending on incarceration rates, remedial education, special education, among a lot of others. Oregon has had a fantastic move towards increase as well in teacher quality. This is fantastic because teacher quality is correlated directly to the quality of learning environments, the learning outcomes throughout school. There's a study by UC Berkeley, among others, that supports this. In this session, there are several bills proposed to increase revenue, and I'd like to advocate for legislators to continue consider ways to designate funding from these bills towards early childhood education, specifically Head Start, which serves our population most in need of these services. I would encourage legislators to consider further ways to work towards early childhood education. Thank you.
Thank you. Please, will the next group come forward? And while they're coming forward, can we have Layla Assam, Ron Albers, and Tiffany Mitchell come forward to the on-deck seats. Please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Adrian Inghaus. I'm the Vice President of the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, AFT Local 5017, the Oregon Nurses Association, a mother, and a registered nurse. Thank you, Co-Chairs Devlin and Nathanson, and members of the committee for hosting us today. Thank you for hearing our comments. Every day on a personal and professional level, I see how these budget cuts could hurt everyday Oregonians. Cuts to healthcare result in my seeing everyday people coming to the emergency department and the ICU with catastrophic results to preventable illness, diabetes, cardiac disease, stroke. Take my neighbor, for instance. He had a stroke, which cost over $100,000 in inpatient treatment. That doesn't include his post-hospital rehab, the loss of income to his family, or the mounting medical debt that is driving them to bankruptcy, and other Oregon families as well. Simply preventable. Had he been seeing a nurse practitioner and had access and seeing a physician assistant and having his blood pressure managed, he would be working today, and his illness would have been managed for $10,000 over his lifetime. We have to make a choice, and we must finally tell corporations it's their time to pay their fair share. Or are we just going to let our most valuable resource, Oregon families, be at risk? I am urging the distinguished members of this committee to stand up for Oregon families and make a choice for Oregon. Thank you very much.
Co-Chairs Devlin and Nathanson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to give testimony today. My name's Terry Mills. I'm a nurse educator working right here at PCC. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association, representing over 14,000 registered nurses working in every healthcare setting imaginable. Our state's funding crisis is caused by the choice Oregon has made in continuing to have the lowest corporate taxes in the country. We now have a new choice. Ask Oregon's corporations to pay their fair share in taxes or cut the vital programs that so many of our patients and community members rely on. Our legislature should not be bought. Here are my concerns. The proposed budget framework could cause 355,000 Oregonians to lose their access to the Oregon Health Plan and reduce vital nurse-led public health safety net programs. Cuts will also negatively impact Oregon's 17 community college nursing programs that rely on state funding to support their mission of providing a comprehensive education to meet the demand of Oregon's future nursing workforce. Oregon seniors who live in poverty, whom my students often care for, are only able to return home after hospitalization because of programs like Oregon Project Independence. Families I personally know who are raising children with disabilities, like the Rogers family in Roseburg, whose 3.5-year-old daughter, Gloria, with cerebral palsy. They depend on the Oregon K plan so she can receive quality care at home. We as a society will be judged by the way we care for our most vulnerable citizens, the young and the elderly. You as leaders have the choice to find meaningful ways to raise revenue this session. This includes asking corporations to pay their fair share in taxes. Thank you.
Co-chairs Devlin and Nathanson and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to present testimony. My name is Diane Solomon. I'm a doctorally prepared nurse and member of ONA representing nursing professionals in health and mental health settings across the state. I'm privileged to have practiced as a certified nurse, midwife, and psychiatric nurse practitioner in rural, urban, and tribal Oregon for over 30 years. As a writer, I was also honored to author Senator Mark Hatfield's memoir. Like he did, the Oregon Nurses Association believes and is committed to ensuring our state finds solutions to the funding crisis to protect vital health services Oregonians depend on. As a behavioral health provider, I'm deeply troubled over the more than 355,000 Oregonians who could lose access to the Oregon Health Plan, mental health, and addiction services. As a mother of four, one on the autism spectrum, shout out to all the yellow in the room. I know how critical K-Plan services are to ensuring an entire family's physical and mental health. As an OHSU researcher, I understand Oregon's life-saving and innovative health blueprints, such as Project Independence. I have been privileged to help patients maximize health and well-being from cradle to grave. Each and every one of us here has been touched by a disabled loved one, a neighbor suffering depression, a friend fallen on hard times who can't access basic services, or a colleague burdened by caregiving for a family member. Cuts to these services devastate the health of every Oregon community and diminish each and every one of us.
Thank you. Please, please refrain. The next group come up that's on the on deck, and then the next group before them. Next up will be Linda Moholt, Jim Fitzpatrick, and Robin Hainall.
Hi, my name is Tiffany Mitchell, and I currently work for DHS Child Welfare, but I did work for the Oregon Judicial Department before. And having seen from both sides that employment, I can tell you they are interrelated. We see very many people come from one place to the other. In a recent staff meeting, our supervisor was explaining to us new requirements that are going to be imposed on our workers. A coworker, we'll call her Allison, burst into laughter and said, "Can I just quit now? This is too much. I can't take it anymore." Allison has worked at DHS for years, feeling crushed under increasing workloads with no additional resources to alleviate the pressure. This is not a lone sentiment in our office. I am an office support specialist as of right now, and through the increasing workloads on child welfare caseworkers, I feel the ripple even at my level. As is, I struggle at reconciling whether I should take a lunch at the expense of not meeting my own professional obligations, because I feel that losing even 10 minutes could be unthinkable. I understand your desire to cut extra flesh to help the budget, and I support you in that. But how do you go further than the bone, which is where we're already at? You can't unless you amputate a limb. For all the bad press that DHS and our public safety programs have received, from my perspective, it feels like a lot of it comes from lack of resources just as much as anything else. Further cuts will only exacerbate these problems and sacrifice important Oregon values. You don't have to make those cuts, though. No one has to suffer or be hurt for this. You can look for other solutions like seeking efficiency and raising revenue from those most able to shoulder it. The hint is, it's not essential services or public safety. These issues are interrelated, and we don't need to cut anything. We just need to ask for more.
Yeah. There was supposed to be a Ron Albers as part of this panel. If he doesn't come up at this time, I will not come back to him. So please proceed.
Hello, my name is Layla Assam, and I'm a volunteer with Partnership for Safety and Justice. Partnership for Safety and Justice advances policy solutions to crime that ensure justice, equity, accountability, and healing to achieve safe and strong communities. I'm here today to urge the legislature to continue funding mental health and addiction treatment, victim services, and justice reinvestment, not another prison for women. As you know, Oregon is on track to open a second prison, a second women's prison, which will cost the state millions. In this funding crisis, it's important that we continue investing in programs and services that make our communities safer and stronger, not another prison. I know firsthand how vital these programs are. As I used to be a volunteer chaplain at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility for women, working with women for reentry into the community. Having the proper programs and services in prison and after release enables the former inmates to succeed in their communities and to prevent them and others from committing crimes. It is also important for us to rethink our sentencing laws for drug and property crimes. This is especially critical given that the majority of women, 70% of women in Oregon, are incarcerated for this category of crimes. With the state facing a budget crisis caused by the choice Oregon has made to have the lowest corporate taxes in the country, you, our leaders, have a choice. To prioritize treatment and prevention and ask corporations to pay their fair share, or cut the very programs that Oregonians rely on to make our communities safer and stronger. Thank you very much for your time.
Now, if the next panel will come up, and while they're coming up, we will go on deck. Will be Patrick Roanhaus, Sabrina, looks like S, OSA, Emily Gethard. Please begin.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I realize you have a tough job. Probably nobody here is here to say we have enough money, so take some of it away from us. So I applaud everything that you all are doing. My name is Jim Fitzpatrick, representing the Extension Citizens Advisory Network for Oregon State University. My background, I was a hay and cattle farmer in Eastern Oregon. My kids were raised in the 4-H program. Both of them graduated from Oregon State with marketable degrees and have no student debt. I attribute a lot of this to the education and the background they got from an early age in the 4-H program. I'm here today speaking for the three statewides, the Oregon State University Extension, Ag Experiment Station, and the Forest Research Lab. What we're asking is that the legislature fully fund the $9.4 million this year for the statewides. Without this $9.4 million, it would virtually reduce all of the positions that were created in the last legislative session. Last session, you funded approximately 40 positions to support the statewides. And I have to note that the $9.4 million just maintains the statewides at a continuing level. It does not create any new position, but the statewides as a whole remain strong and benefit all Oregonians. So we're asking that you essentially keep the statewides where they are now. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good
Good evening, or good afternoon, Senator Devlin and Representative Nathanson and members of the committee. I'm Linda Moholt, CEO of the Tualatin Chamber of Commerce, and I'm here today to advocate for opportunity. And I'm talking about the Southwest Corridor. We have an opportunity to move people to jobs and to education and back and forth. Currently, the city of Tualatin has a population of 26,000 residents and over 30,000 jobs. We also have some of the most regionally significant future industrial manufacturing jobs. We have the Basalt Creek area and the Southwest Concept Plan, but we need a way to get people in and out of the corridor. It's graphically, geographically restricted with rivers, wetlands, hills, and we believe that transit is the absolute best way, most efficient, best for the environment to move many people back and forth within the corridor. So we're offering or asking you today to consider funding the Southwest Corridor and to allow us to move this project forward so that we can continue providing access to these fabulous, not only living wage, but family wage jobs that are being created by the wonderful advanced manufacturing STEAM education opportunities. Thank you very much.
Dear representatives and senators, Democrats and Republicans, I'm a 70-year-old resident of Northeast Portland.
Your name, please.
Robin Hunnell.
Okay.
I'm a 70-year resident of Northeast Portland who spent the last 40 years of my life as a university economics professor. I came here today to say that you have created a huge economic mess. And here's the short of it. To be successful in the new global economy, countries, regions, or states will need a healthy, well-educated workforce and first-class public infrastructure. Those who allow their human and physical capital to deteriorate will become economic backwaters. Oregon is on a fast track to become Appalachia West. For lack of adequate funding, you have allowed K through 12 public education in Oregon to deteriorate to deplorable levels. Oregon has the fourth lowest graduation rate and the third largest class sizes in the country, largely because you spend less per student than 34 other states. Unlike 2009, when Wall Street was responsible for causing the Great Recession, which reduced tax revenues and caused budget crises for state governments, this budget crisis is entirely on you. Why are we committing economic suicide by shortchanging public education, healthcare, and public infrastructure? Because we collect less taxes from businesses than every other state in the country. Oregon households pay their fair share of personal income taxes. Oregon property owners pay their fair share of property taxes, and Oregonians pay their fair share of various fees. But corporations doing business in Oregon do not pay anywhere close to their fair share of taxes. It's that simple.
Please, your time is up. Will the next group please come forward? And then on deck will be Carolyn Cohote, Kendra Scanlon, and John Griffiths. Please proceed.
Hello, thank you to the co-chair, Senator Delvin, and Representative Nathanson, and the other members of the committee. My name is Patrick Rowenhouse, and I am a student here at PCC. I represent an untold minority here, that is the people with disabilities that are unseen. I deal with bipolar depression. I also deal with dysgraphia, dyslexia, and also adult ADHD. One of the big issues I want to bring up is open educational resources. And the reason why I bring this up is the fact that as someone with dyslexia, I have to get my books in a digital readable format. That means that my computer can read it back to me because the fact is it's very difficult for me to focus on what I'm reading. But most of the time, for-profit textbooks are very stingy with how they help schools provide those resources to students. Many of the times, schools will have to actually take a textbook, cut it apart, and then have to scan it in page by page into a format that's not even readable by a text reader on a computer. That makes the file size of that textbook over 400 megabytes, which is enormous. When a textbook version that can be read, it can only be 23 megabytes. Now, the reason why I bring this up is that Portland Community College is actually one of the main people in helping try to promote open educational resources. And that's with the staffing of librarian Jen Culladine, math department staffer Alex Jordan, and Professor Ralph Utes, who are trying to create open source resources for the students here. But they don't have enough money to be able to fund the staff to be able to create those resources. The reason why I bring this up is because in schools today, the average cost for a semester of textbooks is close to $1,700 for most students taking a full load. At Rice University, they started the OpenStax textbook program in February 2012 and have saved students close to $30 million since its adoption. Open source resource textbooks help people, not just disabled people, be able to afford college education when it is exorbitantly more expensive and creating a debtor society in which we have to work off our debt to be able to be employed, to be able to be educated and find jobs for the new infrastructure today.
Thank you very much. Next part.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Devlin and Nathanson, and members of the committee for allowing me to speak today. My name is Sabrina State. I am a Marine Corps veteran and a mother of two children, 3 and 4. I am proud to be here today to represent those who look like me and those who don't look like me but share my concerns about higher education. I attend Portland State University for the many resources that they offer students with children. From the three options for childcare to their limited housing for students with children, Portland State seems like a university with an environment in which I could succeed. Portland State also offers a community development degree, which appealed to me. Throughout my community development courses, I have learned that the value of one's community. My community includes the professors who don't blink an eye when I walk into my lectures with my 3 and 4 year old. My community includes the childcare directors who waive registration fees and lower my children's tuitions from $30 a day to $18 a day per child. Peter Block says that a community can transform isolation into connectedness for caring for the whole by building social fabric. Portland State's Veteran Resource Center has done just that under the direction of Felita Singleton, who has led the Resource Center to high values of empowerment, collaboration, retention, and social justice. This VRC offers scholarships, free recreation opportunities, the Veterans Return Project, and will be showing and has shown documentaries that highlight the specific concerns of, as my branch calls us, the fewer of the few. Women service veterans. But continue all of these wonderful opportunities for our nation's veterans, we need the legislation and the funding to do just that. You all have a choice in fixing Oregon's funding crisis through corporate tax reform. That's why we need to invest $765 million for universities, $636 million for community college, and $155 million for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Can we count on you to all fund higher education at this level? Thank you.
You're taking away time from the people to testify, so please, next.
Thank you, Senator Devlin and Representative Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Emily Gothard. I work at Portland State University in the Student Legal Services Office, helping students facing legal issues like evictions, interpersonal violence, and other issues that impact their ability to focus on their education. Students face a lot of challenges right now. Tuition has continued to rise steadily as state higher education funding has shrunk, and students are experiencing rising housing costs. The budget released by the Joint Ways and Means Committee includes cuts to higher education that will result in steep tuition increases that will make college unaffordable for even more Oregonians. The students I serve can't afford that kind of tuition increase, but they also rely on the Oregon Health Plan, the employment-related daycare subsidy, and other critical state services. I know wherever cuts are made, they will hurt hardworking Oregonians who are trying to improve their future. With these kinds of cuts, Portland State University and other colleges and universities across Oregon would have to make choices about which academic programs and student services like mine, which help keep students in school, they would have to cut, which isn't a choice that they should have to make. Our legislature should not be looking at which services to cut when we are 50th in the nation in corporate taxes. Senator Devlin and Representative Nathanson, I urge you and your colleagues to raise revenue this session to protect Oregonians like the students I serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Will the next group please come forward? And while they're coming forward, on deck will be John Culver, Aaron Klein, and Jody Blail. Please begin.
I'm Carolyn Cahoot. I'm a home care worker, personal support worker, working in Washington County between Beaverton and Forest Grove. I urge you to continue funding the home care and personal support worker programs, such as Oregon Project Independence. Thank you for the prior speakers, which enable people to continue to live in their homes. I also urge you to fund programs that are administered under the Department of Human Services, which enable autistic people to employ those, like personal support workers, who can help them with their needs. Our funding crisis was caused by the current piddly taxes corporations have to grudgingly pay, which put Oregon dead last in corporate taxes in this country, which has googles of money. The legislature needs to work on ensuring large corporations doing business in Oregon are not keeping us 50th in the corporate tax world. To do less, to compromise with the above, will create great costs for the state when consumer employers are forced to go into expensive facilities. The facilities will charge the state exorbitant costs, which the state will be required to pay for its own decisions. I urge you to make choices which secure seniors.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Next party, please.
Co-chairs Devlin and Nathanson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present testimony today. My name is Kendra Scanlon, and I am a family nurse practitioner practicing in the Portland area. I am a member of the Oregon Nurses Association, representing nurses providing care in many, many different settings. The budget deficit we face today is the result of Oregon's choice in continuing to remain dead last in the country in corporate taxes. Today we are faced with another choice. Ask Oregon's largest corporations to pay their fair share in taxes, or instead face severe cuts that will destabilize the services our communities depend on. As a nurse practitioner, I am concerned about the severe impact on health outcomes that our state will see if many thousands of Oregonians lose access to the Oregon Health Plan under the current budget proposal. When previously working in primary care during the Obamacare OHP rollout, I found many patients were overjoyed to finally have coverage. I find that patients don't want to rack up emergency costs. Many may have to if they cannot receive appropriate preventative care. Appropriate preventative care is a teamwork enterprise, including a primary care provider. If we don't stop cutting vital funds to our state's healthcare, our healthcare expenses could become even more expensive. As legislative leaders, you have a choice this session to protect funding for those important health programs by asking the largest and most profitable corporations in our state to pay their fair share. I strongly urge you to seek viable solutions so that we can avoid these devastating cuts to our healthcare system. Thank you very much.
Please, next person.
Hello, my name is John Griffiths. I'm an adult who experiences a disability. I receive services, disabled services, and as the sign says, funding is a matter of life and death for those with disabilities. My helpers help me out every day. They keep my situational awareness, which is pretty bad, and prevent me from hurting myself or getting hurt by something else. Without these people, I would be dead now. So please, as the sign says, funding is a matter of life and death for those with disabilities. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Will the next group please come forward? While they are coming forward, can Angie Unger, Linda Gear, and Scott Bailey come on deck.
Hi, my name is Aaron. I'm a volunteer with Partnership for Safety and Justice and Circles of Support and Accountability. It's COSA for short, and thank you to my Representative Smith Warner and Senator Denbrough for being here and the rest of the committee. Partnership for Safety and Justice advances policy solutions to crime that ensures justice, equity, accountability, and healing to achieve safe and strong communities. And COSA seeks to end sexual violence against children and adults by ending offender recidivism. I'm here to urge the legislature to continue funding mental health and addiction treatment, victim services, and justice reinvestment, not another prison for women. As you know, Oregon is on track to open a second women's prison, which will cost the state millions. In this funding crisis, it's important that we continue investing in programs and services that make our communities safer and stronger, not another prison. And it's important that we support families in Oregon. I know firsthand how vital these programs are. Through my work as a COSA volunteer, an offender who was deemed high risk has lived safely in our community for more than a year and now has a job, lives in supportive housing, and is accountable to members of our community. It's also important for us to rethink our sentencing laws for drug and property crimes. This is especially critical given that the majority of women in Oregon are incarcerated for this category of crimes. With the state facing a budget crisis that's through our own choices to not tax our corporations, our leaders have a choice: prioritize treatment, prevention, victim services, and ask corporations to pay their fair share, or cut the very programs that make our communities safer and stronger and keep families together. Since I have 30 seconds, someone lost their notes on the floor, so I'm going to read their testimony. Our elders should not have to choose between a roof and starvation or life-sustaining medicines. What choice can we make now as representatives and constituents that will restore dignity to the elders who served our community, our country, and communities all their lives and ensure our future generations will thrive instead of only struggle? You guys have a choice. Please make the right choice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jody Bliley from Eastside Portland Air Coalition, and I'm asking you to fully fund Cleaner Air Oregon, and I'm asking you to please make corporations operating in Oregon pay their fair share. Last year, Portlanders found out through a U.S. Forest Service study that we were being poisoned due to state laws that put corporate profits over human health. We worked to get that polluter to filter, to get other polluters to filter and change their practices, and we fought for reform that would help all Oregonians. The reform is called Cleaner Air Oregon, and I ask you to please fully fund it and, most importantly, to make corporations pay their fair share to do so. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is John Culworth. I'm a 5-year Marine Corps veteran, and I'm here on behalf of many veterans that are in this room. We have come out in force to show how important this subject is. We rely on the Veterans Resource Center like this one right here on PCC's campus. I am from Rock Creek campus. I owe my life to this center. I am a suicide survivor from the struggles that we have encountered in the military. That center has saved 6 lives just this year from suicide attempts as a safe haven for veterans. We wish that the Oregon Opportunity Grants for veteran resource centers and other centers in the colleges be supported and maintain support. Also, the Senate Bill 143 is coming up on February 16th. We are begging for your support on that. I have survived. I have many close friends that have survived because we have found a safe haven on the campuses for this reason. It is vital, and we ask for your support. That's all I have. Thank you.
And the next group, move forward, and while they're moving forward, on deck can be Angie Unger, Linda Gear, and did I recall those? Okay. So on deck will be Natalie Vega, Ashley Oakley, and Rob Fulmer. And Natalie Vega, Ashley Oakley, and Rob Fulmer. Please proceed.
Hi, my name is Angie Unger, and I'm proud to be with CareWorks, who is here with me today as a support. I'm a mother of 4, 3 of which are high needs with different disabilities and daily needs. I've been a stay-at-home caregiver for them for the last 6 years. I struggled and fought for them to get the care and support that my children needed, asking and at times demanding for any type of help, classes, support programs, specialists, anything, with little to no results or the price of the programs and classes were too much for my family to pay. Until roughly 4 years ago, when the state decided that I could not adequately care for them, and two of them were taken into the system, and I was told to get them back, I had to take the same classes and programs that I had been asking for. I took them gladly, but the turmoil and anguish that my family had to go through just to receive the care that we needed for them still haunts us and would have been avoided if these programs and supports were available to us and the need, and without the need of causing more problems by removing our children. This is unacceptable. I'm also a client in need of caregiver. Fibromyalgia, seizure, and Meniere's are just some of the diagnoses that I have. For the last 3 years, I have once again fought for myself to get the care and support that I need. My diseases cause me to have severe pain, forgetfulness, lose consciousness, drop things, and multiple falls, some that result in serious injuries. I just recently, in the last 6 months, after fighting and fighting, was able to get a caregiver. Reasons for denial before was my age and diagnoses that weren't recognized until recently as a disability. Although I am grateful for the caregiver, I was only given 45 hours a month, 2 hours a day, Monday through Friday. And in those 2 hours, they're supposed to help me with breakfast, lunch, and dinner, my essential needs, going to the bathroom, shower, taking meds, and so forth, also to monitor for any falls or seizures, leaving me on my own for the rest of the day. Falls and seizures do not happen on a time schedule, and it is impossible to get all that done in 2 hours.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Devlin and Nathanson, and members of the committee, including my two legislators. My name is Scott Bailey. For the last 30 years, I've worked as an economist, initially with the state of Oregon, but mostly in the state of Washington and Vancouver. In the state of Washington, they are substantially increasing their educational funding right now because their constitution requires good funding for education. They are investing, we are not. For the last 20 years, I've been a public school activist, including the 17 years that my kids were in school. We had 1 year where there wasn't budget cuts. I'm also a candidate for the Portland School Board in the May election. I worked hard on school quality, but I can't tell you the number of years where halfway through the school year, we had to stop our initiatives and focus on school funding. I worked hard to see Measure 97 passed. It didn't, because I saw that as the only solution that's come forward in the last 20 years. Regardless of how you felt about Measure 97, there were 2 points of general agreement. One, not enough state revenue, and two, corporations don't pay enough. You probably know that the corporate share of the income tax dropped from about 18% down to, what, 9% or 8%, something like that. You may not know that the same is true on the property tax side. In the late 1960s, commercial and industrial interest paid about 72% of the property tax. Now it's down to below 40%, I believe. It's time to invest. It's time for corporations to pay their fair share. We need to do that.
Thank you. Next, please.
I could go on, but you've heard from people here. You're going to hear more. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Linda Gear.
And I'm going to read what Linda dictated to me. My name is Linda Gear. I've lived in institutions such as Fairview and group homes for 28 years of my life. But since 1991, I've been able to live on my own with the support of home care providers. They don't pay any of my care providers very much. It's not right. Sorry, out of breath. These care providers assist me with all the things I need to do in my daily life: get the right medications, bathe and dress, cook meals, help me with finances and transportation, and be out in the community, going to appointments and meetings, and helping me get here today. They also give me companionship, and that's what I need the most, really. I get close to my care providers, but so often, because of their low wages, they can't afford to keep doing this work. It is important to pay care providers more so that they can care for themselves and their families without living paycheck to paycheck and being overworked and stressed. They make just over minimum wage, but look at all they do. My care providers are always there when I need them, and they treat me with respect. If we didn't fund programs that give people with disabilities the support we need to stay in our own homes, I'd have to go back to an institution. But I won't go back. I'll fight like hell to not go back to one. In the institutions, they weren't nice to people and denied us our full rights. They didn't like me because I stood up for people who couldn't speak for themselves. In the last year, I joined CareWorks because I want to help people who can't speak for themselves, and I want care providers to earn more so they can stay in their jobs. We need more revenue to be able to invest in the care system so that people can have the choice to live in their own homes and receive care and be able to live where they want to and feel comfortable. Legislators have a choice, the choice that we not continue being 50th in corporate taxes and make sure services don't get cut.
Thank you very much. And on deck will be Leslie Weaver, Kendra Scanlon, and Hillary Booth or Ruth.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello, my name is Rob Fulmer, and I'm a higher education worker providing technology services to students, faculty, and staff at Portland State University for more than a decade. Until last year, I represented non-faculty employees on the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'm a proud member of SEIU, like Local 503. So Oregon is in a boom economy, relatively, right? Unemployment is down, earnings are up. Despite these positive conditions, the state faces a massive structural deficit because our fixed costs have increased and will continue to do so. At the same time, we have a broken tax system, and I have to disagree a little bit with what Professor Hunnell said earlier in that, okay, we the citizens are partially responsible for breaking it. You all know that, right? We passed Measure 5. We passed these unfunded mandates, and we need you guys to fix them. Sorry. I mean, you need to pass something to refer back to us. We'll work with you, but it's really on all of us. It's not just on you guys. So I just wanted to clarify the record there. Okay. Anyway, individual taxpayers are pulling their weight in this state. We know that, but unless big corporations do the same, it's going to mean huge cuts to schools and services. We've been here before. We'll be here again unless we do something to fix it. For higher education, this means increased tuition. We're looking at high single and low double digits among the seven universities. You guys know that that situation for students who carry debt, which is pretty significant. But what's more concerning is the students that can't afford to finish. Because one of the things that I saw in the HEC was that that the worst situation is the student who goes to school and doesn't get a degree, right? Because they incur debt and they don't get it. But anyway, this is the part I wanted to focus on, which is if we can't fix this revenue problem now during when the economy is good, consider what it means should it sour under the stewardship of the amateurs we have making policy decisions at the highest federal levels, right? We have an obligation to protect our state against the dangerous situation we are in, and we cannot fail to act now. Thanks.
Hello. Before I introduce myself, I would like everybody sitting at the table to please turn around and look at the totem pole behind you. I want to acknowledge that we're on the Multnomah Tribe of the Chinookan People's Land. My name is Ashley Oakley, and I work with Head Start and Early Head Start at a culturally specific organization called the Native American Youth and Family Center. I'm here to tell you about the huge wait lists and lost opportunity for our early learning programs. Early learning is the most efficient investment for our children. Please fund culturally specific early learning to its fullest. Also, Native American students need to be included in our K-12 curriculum to reduce the dropout rates for Native American students. We need to support Senate Bill 13, tribal literacy. We need to support our tribes in teaching accurate, culturally appropriate, and community-led curriculum. I have heard hundreds of horrible stories about playing games like cowboys and Indians, teaching history as if European colonizers discovered America, as if there wasn't a genocide of our people, celebrating Thanksgiving with construction paper headdresses. I even heard a white child tell a Native American child, "You can't be Native American because they are all dead." Then we wonder why our Native students drop out of school is at such disproportionate rates. Please fund culturally specific early learning, and please pass Senate Bill 13, tribal literacy. Thank you very much for your time.
Now, who should be coming up is Leslie Weaver, Kendra Scanlon, and Hillary Roth. I think I'm missing someone. But on deck, coming forward, will be Martha Pierce, David Van Spakbrock, or Kevin and Kevin Fitz. Please begin.
Hello, I'm Hillary Booth, and thank you, committee members, for allowing me for testifying today. I'm an infectious disease epidemiologist, and I work at the Oregon Health Authority, where I've worked for the past 10 years to protect the health and safety of Oregonians. I'm here today to advocate for public health. It's worth noting that my position, like the majority of the staff in my department, is federally funded. We do not receive enough state funding to conduct the core public health work that our agency is charged with, like investigating outbreaks of foodborne disease or tracking multi-drug-resistant infections that are acquired in Oregon hospitals, or responding to influenza pandemics. In 2013, the Oregon legislature recognized the need for significant upgrades to the governmental public health system when it passed House Bill 2348, the Public Health Modernization Act. This aimed to ensure that core public health services are available in every part of Oregon. Unfortunately, this has been a largely unfunded mandate, and there is no money allocated for this purpose in the co-chair's budget for the next biennium. Because there is a predicted $1.8 billion revenue shortfall for Oregon this biennium, funds are not available to modernize public health or many of the very important state services that Oregonians need. But we know where we could find this money. We know that when it comes to taxing corporations, Oregon is dead last. So, committee members, I want to remind you today that you have a choice. You can either cut the public services to which all Oregonians are entitled, or you can end this harmful cycle of allowing corporations in Oregon to evade paying their fair share of taxes. I implore you to do everything you can to protect the health and safety of Oregonians and fund critical public health services.
To the next party, please.
I'm here to speak for Leslie Weaver, who could not be here to give her testimony. Would it be all right to submit it? She's feeling ill and was having trouble with her wheelchair.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Leslie Weaver, and I'm here to speak about the importance of investing in services supporting people with all types of disabilities to live in their homes with dignity and health. What this means to me as someone who relies on these programs is, one, funding to reduce the loads of caseworkers so they can better support their clients, two, better supports and information for clients who are tasked with finding and hiring their own providers, three, professionalization and better training for care providers, four, access to quality care in the amounts that we need it to keep us in good physical and mental health, and five, paid leave for our family members who often have to care for us in the case of the loss or illness of a provider. Currently, this system and the level of funding we have is not working for clients like me and our families or the providers who care for us. I have been through 20 care providers in the last 12 months, and I have been without a care provider at all for over a month since my last provider quit without any notice. Because I need support getting in and out of bed and meeting my basic needs to live independently, my daughter and son-in-law have had to travel an hour each way to my house by public transportation at least once a day, every day of the week during this time. And even with their help, many things that would normally be the responsibility of my care provider are left on my shoulders. This is very stressful, and I am often unable to keep on top of all of it with my memory and mobility problems. This is my life. It's what's happening to me, and the support isn't there. We can't afford any more cuts to our care system. I'm asking you to listen to my story and realize change is needed. And the only way change can happen is if you choose to get more revenue by making corporations pay their fair share in Oregon. The burden of the state budget should not be on the shoulders of people who need to rely on support services in our daily lives.
Okay, we'll bring the next group up. The next group should actually consist of Martha Pierce, David Van Spreebrock, and Kevin Fitz. And I only see one person at coming forward. So I
assume that means I get 6 minutes?
No. So I'm going to call up the next group, and I won't be able to come back to those people. So the next group after this will be Elisa Porter. Patrick Storm, and my goodness, maybe a testament we need handwriting in school. Donatur Petrov, I cannot tell. Donatur Dumitr, okay. Please proceed.
I'm Dave Van Spaybrook. I'm a civil trial attorney at the law firm of Sussman Shank. I am the volunteer chair of the Multnomah County Justice Reinvestment Steering Committee. This is the policy committee that was formulated to make Multnomah County's response to Senate Bill 3194. This committee is an unprecedented collaboration between Multnomah County judges, law enforcement, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and the probation department and treatment providers. These groups worked collaboratively together to develop the Multnomah County Justice Reinvestment Program, or, and I know this is a bad acronym, MCJRP. I am here to request that that program get fully funded. I got involved in justice reinvestment as a private citizen because I visited a client on a civil matter who was in a correctional facility, and I was struck by the huge expense of prisons. The parking lot is always full, and it is not because the inmates have cars. Inside, you see that the lives are wasted. Sometimes that's how it has to be, but I wondered if there was a better way, and there is. In response to Senate Bill 3194, the steering committee developed the MCJRP program. We were committed to finding a way to make sentencing more informed so that prison usage was more efficient. If I told you that you should build a superhighway from Salem to Tillamook because I had a gut feeling that people would use it, you'd laugh in my face, and rightly so. Prison beds are also a limited state resource like road funds, and most sentencing before that was done based on the gut of the prosecutor. We have spent $8.1 million. We have avoided costs of $17.2 million. This program pays for itself. We also are getting a better result. Our recidivism rate is 2% below what it was for a comparable group. That sounds like a tie. It's not, because I'm talking about a more high-risk group. We have fewer people going to prison. We are spending less. We are getting a better result. And we should continue this program so that we spend less on prison and have more funds for schools. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next group, come forward, please. And while they are coming forward, on deck will be, Brent Finkbeiner, Tanya Bennett, and Maude Hines.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dmitry Petrov, and I am here to speak for Better Oregon. Our funding problem is a direct result of the choice Oregon made to have lowest corporate taxes in the U.S. Now we can make a better choice. I have a small construction company business, and many of my customers are low-income people. If they have to choose between food on the table or this sagging fence, they will choose food. This hurts my business, and that hurts Oregon economy. Now you have a chance to make a better choice. Asking big corporations to pay their share is the best choice for Oregon. Thank you very much.
Please proceed.
Thank you. My name is Patrick Story, and I volunteer with the Citizens Advocacy Group, Tax Fairness Oregon. We're sometimes called a watchdog because our motto is, we read the bills and follow the money. Nobody ever said that would be easy, but now it is alarming. Since our founding in 2003, state legislators have accumulated over $830 million in the biennium budget for business tax breaks, including for some of the world's most profitable corporations. Now that there is a $1.8 billion budget deficit, we are working harder than ever in the spirit of our Oregon values to protect funding for public education and for our most essential social services. Therefore, we ask you not to pass any new business tax breaks this session. Please tell the following to anyone asking for new tax breaks. You must identify and win a source of funding, whether it's finding new revenue somewhere or else ending an existing tax break. Finally, there are at least already five bills currently before you that would make the estate tax more generous to the wealthy. We ask you not to pass any of those. And so in conclusion, I ask you committee members, we implore you, please maintain discipline this session. No new tax breaks. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Elsa Porter, and I too am a volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon. Every session we read hundreds of bills, as you do. And I was especially alarmed this session in reading the bills to find so many, a preponderance of the bills that I read were requests for tax breaks, a tax credit here, an abatement there, grants, all draining the state's coffers and all diminishing the state's ability to meet its basic needs. As Pat said, we calculate the accumulated tax breaks cost the state at least $830 million a biennium. Now that is just about half of the deficit that we are facing today, just about half. We note that the agendas on your committee hearings are loaded with new tax breaks or sunset extensions. So we implore you to show real discipline this year. Say no to any new tax breaks. Say no to the sunset extensions that fill your agendas today. Unless their value has been measured, has been measurably demonstrated, and are more important to our statewide well-being than schools, health care, social services, and public safety. Thank you.
Thank you. Please, could the next group come forward? And while they are coming forward, on deck will be Morgana Sneed, Nira Sneed, and Taylor Bacon.
My name is Brent Finkbeiner, and thank you, Chairs Devlin and Nathanson, and members of the committee for allowing me to speak before you today. I am a proud Army veteran, a former combat medic, and I've spent the past 2 years studying at Clackamas Community College. I earned my associate's transfer in business, and now I study business management and leadership at Portland State University. During my time in higher education, I've had a great number of successes and held various leadership positions serving students. Now I'm the chair for the Senate for the Associated Students of PSU. The only reason I've gotten this far is due to the love and support that I've received from this community. I owe a large part of who I am today to our communities here in the Portland metro area. After my deployment to Baghdad in 2008, I went to a very dark place where I had left my sense of purpose overseas. While mental health services brought me back from the brink of self-destruction, it never restored purpose to my life, and I stayed in darkness with no light to follow. That was until I decided to use my GI Bill and go to college, but the only way to do that was with help from veteran services that went beyond tuition. I was trained for combat, not for the classroom. I needed people to bring me in and tell me that I could do this. That is why I stand firmly on the ideas of veteran priority enrollment, veteran loan programs, and a healthy increase for funding for veteran resources on all campuses. That is why I stand firmly on the belief that we need $765 million for universities, $636 million for community colleges, $155 million for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, because only education can truly save us, but not if students earn degrees and they're drowning in debt. It's up to you to fix this revenue problem. It's up to you to fix the budget, and it is up to you to hold corporations accountable so that we can allow more citizens to enter college, which will translate into a healthier workforce and a healthier economy. Thank you all for your time and consideration.
Thank you. The next person, please.
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Nathanson, and members of the committee, my name is Tanya Bennett, and I am studying community development at Portland State University. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today to put a personal face on the value of public funding of education. I come from a very dysfunctional past, but I have two sons that education has changed their future. My oldest son, who has earned his degree in medicine and in business, will pursue a degree in a career as a doctor. My other son has finished the academy for firefighting and is currently working as an ambulance driver and serves his community as an EMT. While with my degree, I intend to return to Douglas County to work towards building programs of mentoring youth and youth outreach to address the impact and effects of generational poverty. I feel that the public investment in education, especially higher education, is the most important investment the public can make in our future. Education provides the ability to both ensure a livable wage, but also aids our citizens in the ability to engage intelligently in the issues we all face today. Youth in small towns and rural areas in Oregon are faced with few opportunities. When you don't even know what can be available, you limit your options and outcomes you can create. State funding of education is important to show that we value these opportunities and choose through our support to encourage all members of our state to participate. It is the participation that will ensure the prosperity of our state and our citizens. Public investment in our educational services is essential to all. In closing, thank you for your time, and I ask that you add at least an additional $100 million to Public University Support Fund and prioritize need-based aid to help students like me afford the dream of a college education. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please. Co-chairs Nathanson and Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Maude Hines, and I am a faculty member at PSU, a member of our Board of Trustees, and a native Oregonian. Our public universities are asking for an additional $100 million in funding to maintain our current level of service. And what I'm here to do today is to share with you some of my experiences with our current level of service. As a faculty member, I've had to make accommodations to students and PSU's economic situations. I teach larger and larger classes, giving less individual attention to my students. I have students unable to shell out the $10 or $15 per novel it takes to have books early in the term before their financial aid arrives. I've seen a student come to class with a broken wrist she couldn't afford to cast because she didn't want to miss my lecture. I've got students who ask with downcast eyes if they can arrive 15 minutes late to class because their job schedule has changed and they're scared of getting fired if they don't accommodate the changes. I've seen promising students drop out of college to work full-time at jobs unrelated to the careers they're preparing for at PSU. As a board member, I've watched state funding decline and expenses continue to rise. I've watched the university create efficiencies to steer the burden away from students, but those only bridge part of the gap. Voting to raise tuition while thinking of my own students, some of whom are already working three jobs to pay for college, is excruciating. Our students, many of whom are the first in their family to attend college, I see the red light is on, please don't make me make the decision to vote to raise tuition 9% at PSU.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Will the next group please come forward? And while they're coming forward, can Alberta Davidson, Vina Rainwater, and R. Dale Pack please come forward? Please proceed.
My name is Taylor Bacon. I work at Trillium Family Services at the Perry Center for Children. By choosing to cut funding to mental health services, you are choosing to make Oregon's most vulnerable children fend for themselves. With our foster care system already as overburdened as it is, children are living their days in DHS offices and their nights in hotels with overworked DHS employees. This is very detrimental to the mental health of our children, leading to long-term dysfunction that spreads easily throughout our classrooms and communities. You should take this opportunity to stop this epidemic while you have the chance, before it becomes impossible to reverse. Bottom line, we should not be cutting funding when we are not in a recession. It is time to choose to find the funding by making corporations pay their fair share rather than making cuts that impact our most vulnerable citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you for choosing to spend your Saturday here with us. My name is Morgana. I chose to support my family of five with a career as a home care worker and personal support worker here in our Oregon, state of Oregon. My choice has led me on an amazing journey as an advocate for my elders and adults with disabilities while helping them ease their burden with activities of daily living that most of us take for granted. We have watched in recent years how corporations thrive here, raising prices at whim, while elders I work with and my own family and neighbors struggle to choose between paying rent and buying food. Grocery shopping or replacing threadbare shoes should never be a luxury, but it is for many of us. Since we as Oregonians chose to allow corporations to continue extracting money from us without sensibly holding them accountable for their fair share of taxes to reinvest, I have watched my family's income be reduced by about 80% due to cuts to the home care worker and PSW program funding. We are now choosing between basic needs and struggling to avoid homelessness. As Oregonians, by choosing to ignore the basic human needs of our own communities, we are forcing our elders and the families that serve them to choose between a roof and starvation or life-sustaining medicines. What choices can we make now, all of us, as representatives and constituents, for the elders who served, that will restore the dignity to the elders who served our communities and our countries all their lives, either as veterans in the wars or as volunteers as we are, and ensure our future generations as a whole will thrive instead of only struggle? I ask you, please choose wisely.
Hello, my name is Mira, and I've been working as a volunteer caregiver for the past year. My mother is a full-time caregiver, and I'm here today because I'm tired of our elders, among the most vulnerable people in our society, not being able to get adequate care, health care, due to lack of funding because of our choice not to tax multi-million dollar corporations their fair share. As a result of decreased funding, not only does this mean our seniors will not get the adequate care they deserve, but many families will be losing their main source of income. I've already seen multiple examples of this, such as a woman I have helped, a 94-year-old woman. She's so amazing. She has had to let go of her caregiver because her hours were cut. She, like I said, is 94, and she's fairly independent, but being 94, there are things you do need help with, and her caregiver is a single mom. And now that caregiver has to look for other work to provide for her family. As a single mother, every dollar counts, and she is no longer able to take care of this 94-year-old woman she has helped for years now. So I'm asking, after personally seeing too many examples such as this, that healthcare is a priority and not treated as a luxury. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Now will the next group please come forward? And actually, this group should have been Alberta Davidson.
You had Alberta Davidson?
Yes.
Yes, she asked me to speak to her.
Vina Rainwater and R. Dale Pack. So I'll just go ahead and call up the next group after that to be on deck. We'll not call those parties again. Anna Petrow, Marnie Spoons, and Catherine Saltzman. Please proceed.
I'm Irene Longeville, speaking for Alberta Davidson. I want to thank all of you for coming all over the state of Oregon. It's the first time I've met you. Thanks for being here. I have several things that I would like to mention. One of them is that we have taken personal finance out of the public schools. Now, a lot of these people who are in debt would have not been in debt had they learned how to work their finances. My children had to go and find an apartment, had to be able to figure out how much they made per hour, and then deduct the deductions that you don't get. You have to have your gross is not your net. You also have to realize that children come from where their parents are normally very honest with them, to signing contracts where the word honesty never even enters into those businesses' relationship with children, who are still 18. Second of all, and I live in low-cost housing. I did work all my life. I went to college as an adult. We need real housing. I am a vet. We are having more vets come into our building. We need more. We can, it will help so much. The other thing is I really want to thank you for everything that you have done, and I know how hard it must be to have someone giving you a song and dance we would all buy, and then have to figure out how we're going to be able to take care of the real people who desperately need help. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Will the next group please come forward, and while they are coming forward, we obviously will not be able to get to everyone that has signed up, so we're going to start going around and getting a little bit more variety. So I'm going to ask Stephanie Benicek, Matt Utterback, and Betty Reynolds to come on down. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Senator Devlin and Representative Nathanson. Thank you for allowing us to testify today. Oregon is facing a shortfall of approximately $2 billion for the biennium. This is because Oregon made a choice to have the lowest corporate taxes in America. This has really strengthened the corporate profits, but it has weakened our state economy. And this especially impacts the schools and our senior services. Better schools produce healthy, produce earners. I'm going to start that sentence over again. Better schools produce a healthy, better earning workforce. Healthy retirees contribute to the economy, and seniors in need of extra help can get it. Oregon has often been a leader for human rights and human opportunities, but now Oregon needs to make a choice, and that choice must be between corporate profit that make large corporations even more wealthy that do not pay their fair share, or to benefit the Oregon economy itself, which would provide a benefit for us all. Thank you.
And could you give your name for the record, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Anna Petrov, P-E-T-R-O-V.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Hello. Thank you for taking our testimony today. My name is Catherine Salzman. I'm a member of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition, and I've lived in Southeast Portland for 35 years. Last year, our neighborhood found out that our families had been being poisoned by unregulated toxic heavy metals for decades. I am here to ask you to fully fund Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. I really want to see the governor's Cleaner Air Oregon regulatory overhaul project succeed. We have an opportunity now, an unprecedented opportunity, to set a new standard, a new way of doing things at the Department of Environmental Quality, where human health and the health of the environment are at the center of regulatory policy. And because our federal regulatory agencies are in jeopardy, this work is more urgent than ever. We depend on clean air, clean water, and uncontaminated soil for our lives. Everyone does. It's not a partisan issue. If we don't have those things, we won't have anything else. I want to see the DEQ be able to do what they are supposed to do, what we thought they were doing, what most of their staff expected to be doing when they started their careers, and what they would be doing if they were adequately funded and had the resources. Because there will be budget arguments, I want to mention the mythical antagonism between a strong economy and robust environmental protections. This old argument hides a failure of imagination and ingenuity, and it's not true. It's not true in California or Washington State, in Europe or Louisville, Kentucky, and it won't be true in Oregon. People love Oregon and want to be here because it's gorgeous. Let's do whatever we can to live up to our green reputation and preserve our beautiful home. Please fully fund Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you, committee, for the opportunity to testify and for being here on a Saturday. My name is Marnie Spoons, and I'm a member of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition. First, I'd like to acknowledge the obvious today, that people here with diverse essential needs are forced to beg for scraps while corporate profits multiply exponentially. I'm a mother and a neighbor of Bullseye Glass and the decades neglected cadmium arsenic hotspot. identified by the Moss study a year ago. The DEQ's mission statement says it's here to protect the airshed and the environment of Oregonians, but since the Moss study became public, too many cracks and missteps have created a distrust of the DEQ by our poisoned neighbors. Without a deep commitment to their mission statement and to the culture change within, no amount of money will help the DEQ, but there's Cleaner Air Oregon, a massive regulatory overhaul. Now that I've seen CAO in action, I have faith that the advocates participating in this massive regulatory overhaul will demand and ensure the change we desperately need to stop the people of this beautiful state from being poisoned. If the huge resources of time and money and energy spent on Cleaner Air Oregon is going to amount to anything at all, it will need the teeth to enforce protective regulations, or else industry will just roll their poisoning of the public and our airshed into the cost of doing business. The only way to give the DEQ the strength it needs to hit polluters where it hurts, to protect the public and the land, to enforce these new regulations is to make sure it's fully funded. Corporations need to be paying for this funding. Polluter pays. I'm here to ask that the DEQ be fully funded and fully held accountable. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Will the next group please come forward? While they're coming forward, on deck will be Sarah Johnson, Casey Wheeler, and Kalinda Capadea.
Good afternoon, I'm Matt Utterback. I'm superintendent of the 17,000 student North Clackamas School District. I'm currently in my 28th year serving students in North Clackamas, the last five as superintendent, and I have the honor this year to serve as Oregon Superintendent of the Year. As educational funding levels between $7.8 and $8.02 billion would require the North Clackamas School District to make between $10 and $13 million. In reductions to avoid deficit spending. These reductions would impact all students, especially our most vulnerable student learners, by increasing class size, eliminating intervention programs, reducing educational options that support the education of the whole child. Consequences of this funding level could include cutting teachers and staff, the equivalent of 100 to 130 teaching positions, resulting in escalating class sizes. With secondary class sizes already averaging 31 students per class at the secondary level, these teacher cuts would raise class sizes by an additional 7 students per class, taking our secondary averages to over 38 students. These funding levels could also mean reducing our instructional days by 19 to 25 days in a state that already has the lowest class or the lowest instructional hours in the country. These funding levels could also mean a combination of teacher cuts and instructional time, as well as the elimination of curriculum adoptions. Our science textbooks are 17 years old. It could also mean the elimination of valuable elective programs. Given that these cuts are coming at a time when Oregon's economy is booming, is equally as disturbing. Any funding level short of $8.4 billion will result in cuts to our school district. And in Oregon and in the North Clackamas School District, we must do better. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Stephanie Beneshek. I'm also a teacher working in the North Clackamas School District. We moved here from Nebraska almost 5 years ago, and although we knew the scenery would be changing, we figured our schools for our children and my job would relatively be the same. We were wrong. My son Gabe was in first grade the year that we moved. He went from a Nebraska kindergarten class of 22 to a Salem first grade class of 37. That's right, 37 six-year-olds learning to read and tie their own shoes in one room with one teacher in a Title I school. That was the largest class I'd ever taught. Previous to that, the largest class in Nebraska was 27, and I was apologized to by the administrator. I had to ask someone, what is a furlough day? Since 2012, Oregon has made a lot of progress. We have not had a furlough day the last 2 years in my district, and after many years, we were finally able to provide a cost of living raise for our employees. But let's be clear, we do not want to reverse the progress we've made. Please consider these points as you make hard choices concerning the budget for this upcoming year. First, Oregon schools need to have at least a 190-day school calendar. Forced to add furlough days due to budget cuts, schools are shortchanging our children their opportunity to learn. Teachers also need a full school year to teach our mandated curriculums. Secondly, class size is a big deal. I have taught classes in Oregon with 32 kindergartners up to even 40 fourth and fifth graders. The class size diminishes the amount of help and time we can give to each child. How do we have state laws that determine a preschool can only have 8 students per teacher, but there is literally no limit to the number of students a teacher serves in a public school? I have every reason to believe that our high class sizes and our shortened school years are to blame for our 74% shameful graduation rate. Please do what you can and make a choice for our children.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Devlin and Nathanson, members of the committee and other legislators. I'm Betty Reynolds, president of Oregon School Boards Association. I also serve as chair of the Clackamas Community College Budget Committee. As property tax limitation measures of the 90s, the legislature showed leadership by stepping in to fill with the general fund what would have been catastrophic cuts to education funding. But in the following decade, the general fund contribution declined as the economy declined, and Oregon's K-12 education has suffered. Teachers were laid off by the thousands, class sizes have increased, and performance declined, for example, despite gains in 2016, our graduation rate was still 48th in the country. The proposed 2017-19 budget framework of $7.8 billion is far below what the Quality Education Commission identifies as needed and $600 million short of what school business officials across the state told us we need just to maintain current service levels. In too many of the state's 197 school districts, it's a cuts budget. Kids are our future, and Oregon's economy is dependent on a well-educated workforce. OSBA has identified revenue reform as our top priority this session. We're asking you, the legislature, to again show leadership in revenue reform and fully fund the quality education model. OSBA and our education partners are eager to work with you in investing in our young people to assure Oregon's future. I want to briefly mention the importance of state capital construction match. Clackamas Community College and so many schools depend on your support for this sorely needed facility funding. Thank you for all you do. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Will next group please come forward? And this group should consist of Sarah Johnson, Casey Wheeler, and Kalinda Capadea. And then on deck will be Jessica Applegate, Terry Parker, and Tom Archer.
Thank you. My name is Casey Wheeler. I'm the executive director for the Columbia Pacific Food Bank in Columbia County and one of the 20 regional food banks in the state of Oregon. Food is the cornerstone of good health, educational outcomes, and economic progress. It is the most basic human need. But Oregon continues to have a hunger crisis. A USDA study covering 2013 to 2015 listed Oregon as the state with the largest increase in food insecurity in the country. We stand at a 16.1% rate in Oregon. This ranks us overall as the sixth worst state in the nation. Oregon spends very little in state general fund dollars and food assistance, relying mostly on federal resources and private nonprofits like the Network of Regional Food Banks, nearly 1,000 affiliated agencies across the state. Governor Brown's 2017-19 recommended budget cuts general fund support for food assistance nearly in half. The regional food banks in Oregon are asking you to invest $4 million into the Oregon Hunger Response Fund in the 2017-19 Department of Human Services budget. This important fund helps Oregon's 20 regional food banks acquire and distribute food throughout Oregon. helping families during times of economic hardship and communities struck by natural disasters. The Columbia Pacific Food Bank supports this request as a necessary measure to help stop the rise of hunger in Oregon. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Sarah Johnson, and I'm a chair of the Multnomah County Leadership and Advocacy Team as volunteers with Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon. Chairs and members of the committee, I want to thank you for your time today. I know there are a lot of people wanting to speak with you. I stand with Planned Parenthood because Planned Parenthood stands with me and over 70,000 Oregonians that it serves. We have 12 health centers in Oregon that deliver incredible value and to public health and our patients. And we want to make sure that OHP patients continue to have the freedom to choose where they get their health care from. Out of pocket, I paid over $5,000 last year, and I'm insured as a young 20-something in Portland. I can barely make ends meet working 40 hours a week, so I'm speaking on behalf of everyone in my generation who has had to work their way through college, work their way to pay off their student loans. We can barely make ends meet as it is with the corporate tax rate as where it's at. We definitely need to manage the population that we have now and make sure that we put Oregon's family first instead of the corporations and corporate tax rate, having it lower than every out-of-state, every other business. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous. I am an able-bodied person who can barely make ends meet. I would hate to see what it's like for everyone else if there are more cuts to the health that's already hard to access as is. Please consider passing the Reproductive Health Equity Act, House Bill 2232, that'll expand access to life-saving and cost-saving reproductive health services for all Oregonians, men, women, and children. Thank you.
Thank you, members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Kalindi Kapadia. I'm a mental health professional in private practice and an instructor at the Portland Community College, the wonderful Cascade campus. I'm here to represent the importance of the Oregon Health Plan and what it means to my clients. I see clients who are teetering on the edge of mental health crisis, including people who have escaped terror and persecution. My clients struggle with an immense amount of shame, fear, and trauma. One of my clients in such dire circumstances, she's a single mother from India. Right now, there is only a little bit of therapy that is holding the bits and pieces of her life together. She's had postpartum depression unaddressed for 2 years, no treatment. If she doesn't have treatment through OHP and access to care, and have her shame and her trauma issues dealt with, then it's anybody's guess as to what can happen to her. She could sink further into depression. Without proper mental health care, she may have no choice but to seek state assistance in other ways. There could be run-ins with the law, or worse yet, suicide. She has 3 children, possible involvement of foster care, and the state would have to pay for it. Of course, not to mention the emotional cost and damage could be permanent. Not to mention, proper treatment could avoid this. With OHP, access to proper mental health care could keep her kids out of foster care and out of the state system. Without OHP, people like my clients would go untreated and the cost would be enormous. Taking away OHP is taking away someone's ability to help themselves and maintain their dignity. Supporting programs like OHP is essential. It's what keeps a civilization civil. We need revenue to do this. It's how we care for each other. Supporting OHP really represents a question.
Thank you very much, please.
Thank you.
Will the next group please come forward? This group should consist of Jessica Applegate, Terry Parker, and Tom Archer. On deck should be Brooke Warren, Colin Robinson, and Roger Kirchner. Please proceed.
Hello, my name is Tom Archer, and I'm a mathematician, and I believe that the business and corporations must contribute more to help the state of Oregon, perhaps not to the extent of Measure 97 more, but certainly some kind of more. I also believe a comprehensive tax reform plan that lowers personal income tax, perhaps has a homestead exemption, and that reduces property taxes and introduces some sort of consumption tax, let's call it a sales tax, would be hugely beneficial to Oregon. This change could be revenue neutral to Oregonians, yet raise significant amount of more money. A sales tax that exempted items such as food, medicine, and housing could likely be much more equitable tax when partnered with the reduction in personal income tax and property tax. There have been several models in the past that have existed. With a sales tax rate of around 5.5%, you could roughly pay for the cost of education in the state of Oregon. One of the criticisms of a sales tax is that it is just one more tax that lawmakers are likely to raise. However, if a sales tax is dedicated to education and only education, any change in this tax would only affect education. If the amount of revenue collected from individual Oregonians is essentially unchanged, but just gathered in a different format, one might ask, why make the change? The surprising answer is that this type of sales tax will raise an extra $1 billion from visitors to our state. That's $1 billion that Oregonians don't have to contribute. That'll get us halfway to solving our shortfall with our unfunded liability. Unfortunately, a sales tax is very unpopular with a lot of you folks up there. In fact, I think the last time we voted on one was 93, and that was goodbye Governor Roberts. I feel sorry for her. She was one of the few persons that stepped forward and really advocated for it. I would urge you to support some sort of sales tax dedicated to education so people have something to vote for and not against.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Jones. You're getting a joint statement from Jessica Applegate. Jennifer Jones, she had to leave. As a member of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition, I am acutely aware of Oregon's air quality problems. Our industries have been poisoning our air. By funding DEQ and Cleaner Air Oregon, and by supporting the Right to Know bill in our legislature, we have a real opportunity for reform for air in Oregon. And I could scare you with real statistics about diesel and heavy metals, and that on an inversion weather day, an average of one senior citizen or vulnerable member of our community will die from pulmonary or heart disease. I have now spent 2 hours in a room with people who are also standing up here desperately asking you for services, and I can't tell you to defund veteran services, education, or health care in lieu of my item. We are all here to fight for the things that each of us knows is imperative to the health of our community. And our responsible public servants, you, are here on this gorgeous Saturday listening to us. How is it possible to choose for any of us who will live and who will die? We need real tax reform in the state of Oregon. We need corporations to pay their fair share, and we need the corporate taxes to make up the budget shortfall. We need them for our veterans, we need them for our seniors, our infrastructure, our health care, and our air. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Terry Parker. I live in Northeast Portland. Hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent in Portland and throughout Oregon to accommodate bicycling. In Portland's 20-year transportation system plan, there's over $800 million of proposed spending for bicycle infrastructure. Outside of Portland, sections of the historic Columbia River Gorge Highway are also being restored, but for bicyclists, not for cars. A reality check is needed. The social engineering must end. Motorists must no longer be viewed as cash cow ATMs that pay for alternative mode infrastructure. Any transportation funding package must be balanced with an equal distribution of privileges and burdens that include license, registration, and or user fees assessed on adult bicyclists. With a minimum charge of $60 a year, any excuse the fee will be eaten up in administrative costs is a deception and no longer valid. There is also a bills in the pipeline that are more about social engineering than about raising revenue. One of those bills is HB 2877. This I call the Big O bill, or Big D bill, excuse me. Dictatorial, divisive, and discriminative. The bill would place a ridiculous and excessive tax on automobiles over 20 years old. It smacks of a discrimination towards low-income people that can't afford a new car, senior citizens that often have older cars, and people that don't drive a lot and therefore have low-mileage older cars. The bill needs to find the big R, the round file. In addition to eliminating social engineering, the legislature needs to tackle the elephant in the room as part of its budget balancing act. You can't ignore peers any longer. I suggest you look at taxing the higher end of the benefits of peers. Finally, I keep hearing about getting the money out of politics. Well, I think it's time to look at the contributions that are made into campaigns and start taxing them. Finally, I too had a contract with the state of Oregon, and it was called Measure 5. Yet my modest home taxes are going up faster than my fixed income as a retiree is going up. And it's because people that could vote on it that don't have to pay for it. Thank you.
Now, if the next group will come forward. This should be Brooke Warren, Colin Robinson, and Roger Kirchner. And then on deck will be Cleo Tum, Jacob Sweet, and Amy Miller.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the time this afternoon. I'm Colin Robinson, a father of two kids in the Ben Lapine School District and the president of the Oregon PTA. I'm speaking today for Every Child with One Voice, urging the legislature to fully fund education by finally dealing with the revenue problem we have here in Oregon. I believe in public education. I'm the product of public education. I believe every child can reach their full potential through public education. I also believe that one day, Oregon will put kids ahead of corporations. When I talk to my kids about their schools and what they need, it comes down to two things: class size and quality teachers. But those aren't the words they use. My 12-year-old son wants to be challenged in his classes, but doesn't get the one-on-one time he needs because one teacher has to deal with 30-plus kids. My 16-year-old daughter is lucky enough to have a web design class, but the teacher who teaches it isn't qualified to teach web design. What message are we sending our kids when we have the lowest corporate taxes in the nation and one of the largest class sizes, the lowest graduation rates, and the shortest school years? The message we should be sending is clear, and it is to corporations, and I've written it for you. Dear corporations, it's time to pay your fair share. Love, Oregon. Thank you.
Senator Devlin, Representative Nathanson, members of the committee, Madam Speaker. My name is Roger Kirchner. I'm the District 2, Region 2 Director for the Oregon PTA. Region 2 is Portland Public Schools. As such, we're the largest school district in the state, and we accumulate lots of students that need special services in special ed, English language learning, and so on. That's largely due because those medical services are found in the metropolitan area of Portland. Other surrounding districts also have similar impacts. If you drive just across the interstate bridge, students in Vancouver receive an education at the end of the 12th year, 1 year greater than do students in the state of Oregon. Today's students are being gypped. In the words of Pogo, we have met the enemy, and it is us. Voters have been duped when they voted for ballot Measure 5 to cap taxes and then thrust the responsibility of education on the state and not provide you any revenue. And now we have the phenomena where we're spending over $30,000 per prisoner and very hardly $10,000 per pupil in our schools.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time to hear us speak. My name is Jeff Honeycutt, and Brooke Warren graciously gave her time slot to me. I am currently a math teacher in the Beaverton School District at the Arts and Communications Magnet Academy. We are a 6-12 school, and I teach all levels of math and all ages of students. We are a school of about 720 students in an old elementary school that comprises 16 classrooms. The last time Beaverton faced a budget shortfall, the district laid off hundreds of teachers and class sizes exploded. I'd like to show you a picture of my seventh grade class. Let's come around here. That year. This class started out with 56 students. By the end of the year, that number had fallen to 53. On the day this picture was taken, there were 9 students absent. You can count there are 44 there. I would like you to reflect on the type of mathematics education these students received that year. As a teacher dedicated to instilling the love of math in my students, I find that it was an impossible task with a number of students in my class. Due to the sheer size, I was unable to do hands-on math activity. Units on measurement, similarity, and circular geometry were relegated to worksheets. Middle school students are a handful, and I love them for it. However, they need a lot of structure. With 56 of them crammed into a classroom meant for elementary school students, group work was challenging to say the least. Being able to get from one end of the classroom to the other to make sure students were on task before the ones you just left got off task again and needed redirection was impossible. Rote book work and worksheets became the norm. Add to this, there were 9 students on IEPs and 504s. These students did not get the help they needed. Under the current budget, Beaverton is facing $18 million shortfall. That's 180 teachers for us. It's time for the state to step up to the plate and get corporations to pay their fair share. Thank you so much.
Next group, please come forward. This should consist of Cleo Tum, Jacob Sweet, and Amy Miller. And on deck will be Stephanie Shao, Melissa Pyle, and Kane Gretz. Please proceed.
Thank you for allowing me to participate in this process today. My name is Jacob Sweet, and I'm here today on behalf of Hacienda CDC and on my own behalf as a foreclosure prevention counselor working in Oregon's foreclosure avoidance program. At this time, Governor Brown's proposed budget includes no funding for this hugely important program that has provided a vital service to struggling homeowners across the state. I'd like to voice my strong support for this program, which I've seen touch so many lives. In 2016, I counseled 70 homeowners towards keeping their homes through this program. What I essentially do is help my clients to understand their options and then help them to navigate the complicated and at times infuriating financial system to work out deals with their lenders. Nothing's ever easy when working with banks. A significant portion of my clients who found a positive resolution in the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program have been working with their lenders for months or even years to resolve their delinquency before they found my agency by way of this program. These are people, to be clear, who very well may have lost their homes, some of them facing homelessness, if not for this program. In addition, the lenders take this program very seriously. They assign their most knowledgeable representatives to handle cases, and the face-to-face resolution conference mediations provide an indispensable format for important communications to take place that otherwise might be lost to the overseas call centers of these lenders. In an era that promises significant deregulation of the financial sector, Oregon homeowners cannot afford to lose the protections and vital counseling services that this program provides. The hugely successful HAMP loan modification program is now over, and homeowners' home retention options are left to the whims of investors in lofty Wall Street offices. Our president has vowed to repeal Dodd-Frank and neutralize the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau by appointing a crony as director. We have every reason to expect that homeowners' rights under federal regulations will be completely removed and trampled in short order. Just this month, I've seen an atmosphere of lawlessness in the mortgage servicing industry and have had multiple cases in which mortgage servicers have completely shirked their obligations to respect my client's right to a debt renegotiation under CFPB guidelines. This is completely unacceptable. I ask that the state of Oregon step up and affirm its commitment to homeowners by funding the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program and housing counseling agencies.
Please proceed.
Yes, and I'm in full agreement of that. My name is Amy Miller, and I am one of his clients. My husband and I have an adopted child, and we were one of the groups that for years, through various lenders, tried to negotiate or even talk to our lenders. And it wasn't until we worked with Hacienda and Jacob's organization that we were able to finally have mediation and get resolution and assistance, or we might have been out, in foreclosure. And, you know, there were a number of issues that happened that for, I'd say, 6 years we were trying. We would have one lender and one person that was assisting us, and we'd go through all of the paperwork and hand it in just like we were supposed to do and what they wanted, all of the documentations and the tax forms and everything they needed, proof of breast cancer, proof of other health issues, things like that. And we were at the end, we were told, and then we'd get a new person or a new lender, and we'd have to start the process all over again. And it was incredibly frustrating and stressful. And what was wonderful about Hacienda and the Oregon Foreclosure Program, and then they also offer counseling, it was wonderful, and it was very helpful, and it would be a shame. It's not even on
the governor's budget.
It's not on the governor's budget right now. I'd encourage you to please reconsider and get it on there. With this new presidency and him and Jacob already seeing issues, I'm afraid that it would be a corporate blinding, and more and more people spending years and years and years trying to resolve their issues, and it'll just get worse. So I would ask for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Will the next group please come forward? This should be Steph Shao, Melissa Pyle, and Kane Gretz. And on deck will be Gabby Swisher, Roberta Yambasa, Doug McClelvin, and I will be taking one more panel after that. Please proceed.
Hello, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Nathanson, and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Pyle, and I am a senior studying urban and public affairs at Portland State University. Like many students at Portland State, I am a low-income, non-traditional student. My story is not unique. There are many like me, first-generation students dependent on funding. But what is different for me is that access to higher education literally saved my life. I am a victim of generational poverty. My parents did not finish high school, and I grew up in an unstable household infected by drug and alcohol abuse. With that being said, I am absolutely dependent on access to funding to finance my education. Higher education has been the stepping stone for me out of this generational narrative. I have spent many years of my life unsure of my purpose and certain that I did not belong, but Portland State is the place for me. I have found a community of like-minded people where I can proudly take ownership of my identities and being a queer woman. I am in an environment where I am being challenged intellectually, and I am meeting and engaging with beautiful and diverse people. And for the first time in my life, I care about my impact and how I can help others. I am in a unique position because not only am I a student at Portland State, but I also work in student financial services, or as many on campus know us, the billing department. I regularly speak with both students and parents that are panicked about making their tuition payments, as well as connecting people to food and housing resources because many are making the choice between paying tuition or buying groceries or even paying their rent. It is very clear that the proposed funding level for the Public University Support Fund is inadequate and there needs to be a greater investment. The universities need at least an investment of $100 million to keep tuition at a modest 5% increase. Due to my financial hardship, I am currently carrying a debt burden of $40,000. So let's help other students like me avoid this.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Good morning, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Nathanson, and members of the committee. My name is Steph Shao, and I serve on the Portland State University Board of Trustees. I'm also a grad student at PSU, and I also completed my undergrad there. As the only student serving on the Board of Trustees, I'm in a unique position to really listen to students and advocate for their concerns. The high cost of education, of higher education specifically, is a subject near and dear to me. I was very fortunate to be able to find multiple jobs to cobble together enough to pay for tuition. One of my jobs is working as a graduate teaching assistant. At PSU, I've taught over 7 classes for freshmen and sophomore students, and my main job is to help educate them and keep them in higher education. In that job, I hear firsthand how they are being priced out of higher education. A lot of my freshmen and sophomore students have to drop out in the middle of the term, in the middle of the school year, as they can no longer afford their higher education. These are bright young minds that are the future business leaders and engineers and other educated people in Oregon. It pains me greatly that these bright young minds have to drop out, and even those who have the money to stay, they have to make the difficult decision between rent, skipping a meal, just to pay for their tuition bills. Unfortunately, the proposed funding level for the Public University Support Fund is inadequate. Our universities need at least an investment of $100 million to keep tuition increases at the modest 5% level. While PSU may have the lowest university tuition in the state, we also serve the most diverse student body. So I ask of you today to please fund that additional $100 million for higher education. Thank you so much.
Well, the next group come forward. This group should consist of Gabby Swisher, Roberta Yambasa, Doug McClellan, and then on deck, which will be our final group, will be Jocelyn Wagman, Nikki Zimmerman, and Katie Zuckerman.
Hi, thank you all for taking your time on this beautiful Saturday to hear from us. My name's Gabby Swisher. I'm a student at PSU, and I'm an intern at Street Roots in Portland. Street Roots is a Portland-based newspaper that provides homeless and low-income individuals with economic opportunity through selling their newspaper on curbs and in front of businesses throughout Portland. Every day at Street Roots, I see the impacts of our housing crisis. These people are driven, hardworking, kind, and deserving, but forced to live on the streets due to systemic issues beyond their control. Market rate housing has not worked for them. It has forced them to live in tents, shelters, and in doorways, exposed to the elements, fighting for their survival every day. I'm here on their behalf, and on the behalf of those most impacted by our housing crisis. I'm here today because I believe that we can live in a state where everyone has access to safe and affordable housing. Oregon's housing crisis is a complex issue that must be addressed with a variety of solutions. Funding the local innovation and fast track program is one integral piece of that puzzle. Affordable housing is crucial for these individuals and families who are able to pay for housing, but for whom the market does not work. There are simply not enough affordable housing in our community to meet the need of those living on fixed incomes, working minimum wage jobs, or supporting families. Funding LIFT will help change that through providing funds to build affordable homes. We know that housing is the solution to homelessness, and the LIFT program provides the mechanism to do just that. We can do more in Oregon to ensure that all Oregonians have a safe and stable place to call home. Thank you.
Chairs Devlin and Nathanson and committee members, I'm Doug McElvin. I fully support using Measure 96 funds to increase the number of Veterans Services officers in Oregon. I'm a life member of the Military Officers Association of America, Portland chapter. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar, and from 05 to 10, I was the County Veteran Service Officer for Washington County. I've given you written testimony and a one-page outline with 4 points, and today I'm just going to focus on my point 4, the potential for economic growth of Oregon in its entirety if we increase the number of Veterans Services officers. I've given you VA data in my outline to you showing that in Oregon, perhaps we only reach about 2/3 of disabled veterans. And we disabled veterans in Oregon receive $1.28 billion in VA compensation and pension. But compare Oregon to Oklahoma. We have about the same number of veterans. In Oklahoma,
the veterans there receive $1.8 billion. In other words, same number of veterans, Oregon compared to Oklahoma, but we only receive about two-thirds of federal payments that veterans in Oklahoma do. It's an easier task in Oklahoma because you have large military installations, veterans clustering around them. Oregon has no large military installation. We are spread out. So I urge you to use Measure 96 funds to the fullest extent to increase the number of veteran service officers around the state, which will increase VA compensation to disabled veterans here and boost the entire Oregon economy. My point two in what I gave you was the history of increasing veteran service officers in Washington County when I was there. There were two veteran service officers pre-2005 when the both the county and this.
Please.
Thank you very much.
Now, if the final group will come forward, this group should be Jocelyn Wagman, Nikki Zimmerman, and Katie Zuckerberg.
Chairs Devlin and Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Jocelyn Wagman, and I'm a Planned Parenthood volunteer. It is more important than ever that Oregon maintains access to basic health care, including reproductive health care, particularly for low-income Oregonians and their families who purchase insurance on the exchange. As both a provider of mental health services to OHP clients and as an OHP client myself that put me through graduate school for social work and public health, I can attest to the tremendous value of these services and the risks associated with cuts in healthcare funding. When we choose not to meet Oregonians' basic health needs, we are choosing unnecessary suffering and sickness, and we are choosing a lower standard of living for all of us as a community. You must choose your priority. We can have the lowest corporate taxes in the nation, or we can fund critical programs. I urge you to put Oregon's families ahead of the profits of out-of-state businesses. Thank you very much for this opportunity, for your time, and for your service.
Thank you. Please.
My name is Nikki Zimmerman, and I'm president of the Oregon School Nurses Association, and I work in Portland Public Schools. I want to acknowledge the difficulty all of you have with the budget shortfall. With all the public here, you need the knowledge of the wisdom of Solomon to try and figure out how to fund all this. I also want to bring out our nervousness and stuff. We feel kind of, some of us are with needed services feel like Oliver Twist saying, you know, give us some more, please. And apologize for that, but I want to get out the school nursing is essential in keeping students healthy, safe, and learning for school. We address the physical, mental, emotional, social needs of our students and bridge health care and education, enabling students to achieve their full academic potential. Through prevention and treatment, school nurses save schools money by improving attendance and increasing time on-time graduation. Giving you a quick look at the numbers from ODE, if you take away the nurses that work one-on-one or with special needs, every school nurse on average has over 4,700 students. Senate Bill 2693 that was passed in 2009 said that Oregon would commit to lowering that rate to the nationally recommended of one nurse to 750 students. And we are right now six times that ratio. Last session, Senate Bill 698 was passed, creating a task force to explore ways to increase funding for schools. And this budget shortfall is hindering the consideration and implementation of their recommendations. Despite the shortage of school nurses, there are many examples of how effective school nurses have been in improving our school attendance, achievement, and helping students achieve life success. For me, the high school I have is...
Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to speak today, and I'm excited to be last. My name is Katie Zuckerman. I'm a general pediatrician and also a developmental disabilities researcher at Oregon Health and Science University. In my clinical practice and also my research, I care for children with developmental disabilities. These include conditions such as developmental delay, speech and language disorders, motor delays, autism spectrum disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. These conditions are very common in early childhood, affecting approximately 1 in 6 kids in the U.S. and Oregon. And we know that early intervention for these conditions is remarkably effective. This is because young children's brains are most plastic, and when we get in early and can give them the kind of treatment that children need, they can make the most progress, and this affects their trajectories over their entire lifetime. Unfortunately, though, we also know that here in Oregon, only a minority of children access early educational services. And in fact, less than 50% of children who have developmental disabilities access those services prior to age 3. And then we also know that once they do access services, less than 1 in 3 kids use the full complement of services that were recommended. We also know that there's significant disparities in who accesses services here in Oregon. So for instance, white non-Hispanic children are much more likely to be accessing and using services, particularly in early childhood, compared to African American children and Latino children and children from low-income families. Although cuts in early intervention programs and early childhood education might seem logical from a short-term perspective, I want to encourage you all to think about the long-term effects of these cuts. The lifetime costs of some of these conditions are significant. For instance, autism spectrum disorder has a cost of about $2 to $3 million to society over the life of an individual. If we can intervene early in childhood for these children, they can get treatment that they need earlier, and this is an enormous cost savings for the state of Oregon. So I really recommend that early educational funding be increased and not decreased in the next budget year. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you on behalf of your Legislative Assembly and on behalf of the full Joint Ways and Means Committee. I'm sorry that we were not able to get to everyone today. I believe this is the largest group I have ever seen for one of these hearings. I also want to thank committee services and LFO staff for being here. Please keep in mind that this is not your only opportunity. We are having hearings in Salem. You may not be able to attend these, but next week we are going to be in Madras and Hermiston, and the following week we're going to be in Ashland and Eugene, and the following week we're going to be in Tillamook. But we will still have hearings in Salem, and you can submit testimony online. The address again is waysandmeans.budget@oregonlegislature.gov. So please thank you for coming here today, and thank you for your patience. This hearing is concluded.